The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
We can't take this madness any longer. Eye for an eye, bomb for a bomb. How can prayers for peace be answered while the battle rages on? No more, no, no more nightmares. No more, no, no more bombs.
Good morning, good morning, Bokato. I hope you know you are listening to Bert Siegel. I really enjoy hosting this show because it gives me an opportunity to catch up with old friends, well, not old friends, friends of long standing. Peggy Mandel, or Margaret, which is her nom de auteur, as we say in Yiddish, has written a book. I mean, I've known her a long time, but I never knew she was such a good writer. And I got the book only because I liked the idea that a friend of mine wrote a book, and the book is just unbelievably moving. It is called And Always One More Time. Let me show it to you. It is a book about, it's called the memoir, but it's really more than that. It's communicating with a loved one who tragically passed away much too young. Her husband, Herb, who was somebody, I can't say we were close friends, but I always admired him. I mean, we were friendly, but he was a psychiatrist. He specialized in adolescence. And so happens, my partner and I know a family who were patients, or their son was a patient of his at one time, having no idea that I knew Herb. And they were talking about what a wonderful therapist he had been for their son many, many years ago. And I said, "Who is that?" Because there was another member of our synagogue who unfortunately passed away quite young, who was an adolescent psychiatrist, Sid Altman. And I said, "Do you mean Sid Altman?" He says, "No, Herb Mandel." I said, "Oh, well, you know." So he obviously was highly respected by the families of his patients. Let me just read from the blurb, because I really think it kind of captures what Peggy's book's about. It says, every year, more than a million women, men too, because I lost my own wife, my spouse, a little over 10 years ago. Over a million women find themselves grappling with the devastating loss of a life partner, a loss that shatters their present and leaves their future in doubt. At 65, Margaret Mandel faces this heart-wrenching reality when she loses her husband of 45 years for a fast-moving disease. The bed is now half empty. Her body betrays her, and laughter seems elusive. And it says, in the depths of longing and haunting by memories, she embarks on a journey of healing through the written word. And it is a book that I really highly recommend. I mean, even if you were fortunate enough not to go through the experience that Peggy writes about and that I lived through, it's a quick read. It's an interesting read. It's moving, certainly. Peggy tells me the book is selling well, and that's good news. I really do recommend it, and not only because I like the writer. You can get it from Amazon. You can get it from a number of different places. It's not depressing, and a book like this can be. And it is really, in many ways, a book that deals with your depression in a very, very effective way. It's hopeful. It's got humor in it. It's moving. And I'm not her agent, but buy the book and read it and recommend it, as I have to a number of people. Peggy, welcome this morning. Why don't you tell us a little bit? I mean, I know you were an administrator at an independent school, you're a yoga teacher, tell us a little bit about who you are, but also what motivated you to do this, because I'm sure a lot of people think they wish they had the ability to do it, and you did it. So there's perhaps some advice that you can give to my listeners, since if we haven't faced the loss of a loved one, as you and I have, chances are pretty good that a lot of people who think it's not going to happen to them, it will. So whatever good advice you could give, please share it with my listeners.
Oh, Bert, thank you so much for such a fulsome and generous introduction. I truly am verklempt. I'm going to start with your assertion that my book is not depressing. To respond to your question about who I am, what I do, and where I came from, because I realized in writing my book that I actually am a very, very joyful person, always have been. Part of the reason I was born in 1951, which was a very, very optimistic time. So I grew up from the very beginning expecting goodness from life because of the time and place into which I was born. So I've always been funny and joyful. And so even in the face of the worst thing that can happen up till now, which was the death of my husband, I wrote a book that is not depressing about a very serious subject. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that, Bert, for naming not just the effect that the book had on you, which is a story of loss, of death. It begins with a death and it ends with a wedding. Mm-hmm. It is a love story about two men. Herb Mandel being my lifelong soulmate and best friend who left me unexpectedly to a fast moving disease.
How old was Herb when he passed away? I'm trying to remember.
He was 66.
Okay.
Yeah. And so who I am is a product of the 1950s, and I grew up in Philadelphia in a very loving home with two Jewish but pretty assimilated parents, as many were in the immediate post-war II aftermath. Many, many American Jews were trying to move forward in this country in their life. And that was my situation. I did go on to become a private school administrator for 20 years, working in admissions at Springside Chestnut Hill Academy in Philadelphia. It's a wonderful, wonderful job. And one of the things I had to do in that job was write a lot, including a lot of letters. Acceptance letters, rejection letters. And I find myself down the road losing my husband after 45 incredibly wonderful years and two amazing children. And I was in shock. I did not seek or receive any kind of grief counseling. I was completely alone.
Did you think about that, about getting, you know, professional help or bereavement?
Here's what happened. 1 week after Herb died, our most amazing rabbi, Joshua Waxman, came to visit me.
A great guy. Right?
And he became my grief counselor. He visited me regularly and spoke, but also listened and with tremendous empathy. But on that first visit, and he knew me well, because not long before Herb died, I had just gone through an adult bat mitzvah with him. And so we were close.
I just want to tell my listeners, they didn't mention it. We know each other from our synagogue. We both belong to Or Hadash. And Josh was also very, very supportive of me. You know, Barbara was ill for 2 years. I always knew that Josh was there for me. And he would both listen and give me good advice. So what you're saying about him is true for me as well.
I am not surprised. Josh said to me, of all the things he has to do as a pulpit rabbi, his absolute favorite thing to do was pastoral counseling. Mm-hmm. He said, because he finds at times of crisis and loss and death, That's when we are closest to God, and that's when he feels he can do his best work in pastoral counseling. So he came to me and basically helped and rescued me during that very difficult time. And one of the first things he said to me on that first difficult week was, "You need to start writing." He also knew I could write and that I was a writer, but beyond that, he understood at some elemental level that writing was going to save me way before I knew or understood it. But because of that commandment to write, and you listen to your rabbi, and I wasn't going to do it, I didn't want to do it, I could barely get out of a chair, let alone start writing, because of the extent of the grief. But because he told me to write, and because I am a pleaser, just to please him, shortly thereafter, I sat down and I wrote my first letter to Herb. I wrote him a love letter. Mm. And then the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, until after 4 years, I'd written 1,000 love letters to Herb. I had no intention of writing a book. These were just private, intimate letters.
Did your children know you were doing that?
Yes.
And they were pleased that you were doing that? Or not?
Yes, of course they were. And of course they were grieving as well. They had lost their dad. And sometimes I would share my letters with the children. And they were difficult to hear because there's so much pain in there. And I had to be very sensitive and careful with my children in terms of not burdening them too much with my grief and pain. They were being very considerate of me not to burden me too
much. And you know what, you're making a very, very important point, because I know I went through that, you know, at one point, because I would use Josh really to kind of make me feel better. And at one point, Josh, you know, had to remind me about his loss.
It's a tricky business, isn't it, Bert, when you've lost a spouse and your children have just been semi-orphaned.
Right.
And everybody's hurting, everybody's grieving, and everybody wants to take care of each other. And it is a very tricky time. And I'm sure among your listeners, there are people who know exactly what we're talking about because they've been through it. So what turned out is I wrote these thousands of love letters, no intention of writing a book, until I read one of my letters aloud in a writing workshop. And the teacher said, "Oh my goodness, there is a love story here. You need to take those letters and write a book." Oh, wow. And that is how it all happened. But it took another several years because I did not just take those letters and publish them. What I did was I worked for many, 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 many months to find the story in the letters and turn the letters through storytelling, scene, dialogue, narrative, to turn those letters into a memoir. And a memoir is a kind of creative nonfiction that entails looking back selectively on your own life and crafting it into a story that someone else would be interested in reading, because the particulars of your own story enlarge to something bigger and more universal to which everyone can relate. And that is how my 1,000 love letters became a 21-chapter book entitled And Always One More Time, which you kindly and generously described at the beginning of our talk. So that's how it all happened. And I found that in the writing of the book, the writing changed me. The book changed me even as I write, because as one writer once said, writing is what you do to find out what you really think.
Let me ask you a question. Is it something, I mean, again, obviously you knew, because even though it was a different kind of writing that you were doing professionally, I always kind of potchkied around with writing. I write a column now for our PAX newsletter. I always talk about the PAC on the show because we dealt a lot with politics. Our side lost the election. It's not the end of the world, certainly, and do everything we can to elect the Democrats in the next election. And you can make a contribution to Democratic Jewish Outreach of Pennsylvania, a message to my listeners. But for people who don't have any history of writing, which you did and I did, do you recommend it for people who think, oh, I don't know how to write, as kind of a therapeutic activity? Or is it something that you think other people would just find overwhelming?
Oh, that's such a great question. I have two answers for you. First of all, when I was writing just the letters, and friends and family suffered the death of a loved one, I became a proselytizer for writing to your lost loved one as a way of course, processing your grief, but also communicating with the person, with the departed person, and maintaining the connection while simultaneously working to let that person go. So for the whole first 4 years of writing the letters, I was holding Herb close and letting him go at the same time, going through all the stages of grief, the denial, the anger, the depression, all of it, which we do whether we write or not. But if you write it down, it elevates and augments and assists the process of letting go and holding on to the person at the same time in a way that you wouldn't otherwise be able to accomplish. So I would tell people, write to them, write to them, write to them. And sadly, a lot of people said, no, I'm not. You're a writer. I could never do that. But some of them will say, yes, yes, I'm going to do that. I want to do that. I talk to my spouse every day. I might as well write them a letter, you know? And so the letter writing. Second answer to your question. Yes, I've written letters all my life. You go to my website. There's an essay there called Becoming a Writer One Letter at a Time, explaining how I basically became now a published author. However, writing letters to my dead husband is not the same thing as writing creative nonfiction, which is a genre that I had never in my life written before. So my steep, steep learning curve, once I committed to publishing my letters, was I had to go to graduate school and basically get a master's degree in creative nonfiction, working with two very, very accomplished, capable, skilled writing teachers. And I did that for 2 years. And that is how the letters morphed into the 21 chapter book you're holding.
So you were comfortable though putting your deepest thoughts on paper?
That's another question.
Paper electronically today.
Okay, that's a third question that comes up constantly.
Well, I have so many questions. I also want to ask you, because I just noticed we only have about 10 minutes left. It goes fast. I also, though, would like to ask you, I know you said, you know, you were raised in a fairly assimilated family or non-traditional family, but I'd like you to mention, you know, how your Judaism, because I know you do take your Judaism seriously, even though you don't think of yourself as a religious person, how your Judaism helped you, if it did in any way, prepare for this tragic loss of Herb?
In every way. And it starts with Herb, because he grew up deeply committed to it and deeply identified and very proud of being Jewish, deeply, passionately in love with Israel. And he really taught me how to love Judaism by loving him.
I knew that about him. You know, that was one of the things that he and I would sometimes talk about. And in fact, one of the things that we did at JCRC is we invited different professionals. We were doing a program to taking God to work and how your belief in your faith helped you in your profession. And Herb talked about that, that he felt that his what you're describing about the person he was, his Judaism helped him as a therapist. So I know that's something he did take very seriously.
I have never in my life been more grateful to have been born Jewish than the day Herb died. No. It was there for me. Rabbi Josh was there for me, but so was all of the history and the tradition, the Jewish way of understanding death and mourning. Exactly. Is so rich and so true, and it's all there for the taking. And I took from it. That's throughout great. My grieving process and to this day. So it has. So my Judaism has everything to do with who I am, who I was in my marriage to Herb, and now who I am with my second husband, John, who happens to be Episcopalian. And yet, John and I attend Torah study every Saturday, and he knows more about the Old Testament, which he calls the Torah, than I do. And so I continue on my journey as a Jew to question and learn, and it is the greatest gift that I've ever been given, was to be born Jewish and then to embrace it through my 45 years with Herb, and to continue to embrace it now with my Episcopalian husband, John.
Mm. Who happens to have a last name that a lot of people think of as a Jewish name, which is interesting.
A lot of people think he's Jewish because his name is Pollock. But when you read my book, you will see that John is decidedly Scottish, mm-hmm. of Scottish descent. And we were married in full Scottish regalia. And
I remember reading that in the book.
And I have never been more committed to my Judaism than I am today. And I am deeply in love with my wonderful Scottish second husband, who loved me back to life, gave me a second chance at love.
And that, and you know what? I mean, personally, I often say to Joy Pollock, my partner, we've been together for close to 9 years now. You do think your life is over when you lose someone, as you and I did, and you think you're never going to have any enjoyment, and you're going to exist. And if you're fortunate, as you know, I know you were, and as I was, it's another chapter. It's not, you know, the first chapter is still there.
You asked me what my children thought of these letters. And I'm often asked what my children thought when I married John. And one of the first things my son Dan said to me after Herb died, and he could see the pain, he said, "More than anything, Mom, I want to see you get your joy back." Yeah. When I married John, the kids told everyone she has her joy back.
Oh, that's wonderful. That I have my joy because that's her name, you know. but you know what? There really is a message there, Peggy, for people who have to live through what you and I lived through, that you can have your joy back if you're open to it. And a lot of people remain widows or widowers after the tragic loss that you and I experienced. And it's not what our loved ones would have wanted. I mean, if they have any control over these kinds of things after they're no longer with us physically, I think if they love us, they want us to be happy again, in spite of the sadness of the loss. We are at 24 minutes after 10. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the people?
Yes.
Please.
There's one more thing. And it has to do with recovering my voice, which is part of the mourning and grieving process. And I've been told that within the memoir, on every page and every sentence, my voice can be heard. Mm-hmm. But I also recorded the audiobook of And Always One More Time in my voice, because I also read that all memoirs were really meant to be read aloud by the memoirist. And so I did record the book. It's on Audible and 38 other audiobook websites where you can purchase it. And I also wanted it to be available for the visually impaired or for anyone who prefers to listen.
So if people want to hear it, how would they get that again?
Well, go to Amazon and you just click on the audiobook. It's on a site called Audible, AUDIBLE. And it's on Spotify and it's on, for those who read audiobooks, there are Libro FM is another site where you can find it. It's all over the place, but it's and always one more time, the audiobook, but you can access it right through Amazon.
That is great. As I said before, I am not Peggy's agent. I just really, and even though, you know, we're friends, if I thought the book was lousy, I'd say, well, you know, you might want to take a look at it. But I far from think it's lousy. As I said, I read it. I've recommended it. I was talking to somebody the other day and I said, look, you know, you haven't gone through this experience, but you well might. None of us ever expect it to happen. I said, read the book, even though it's not your personal experience. I said, it's a good, quick read, and it's encouraging about life, really. I think we all need that in different kinds of ways, and it is an encouraging book, Peggy, and that's one of the reasons I tell people to read it. You don't have to be somebody who is bereaved the loss of a loved one to get something very, very important out of this book. So, mazel tov. I'm sure it was not easy for a lot of reasons, and you know, it's a good read.
Thank you, Bert, and I treasure your friendship.
Oh, yours as well. Take good care. Have a happy and healthy, it is a secular new year. I know you're listening to WWDB, and come back same time next week, and we'll have another hopefully empowering and interesting guest. Thanks a lot, Peggy. Take care.
I'm an bomb for a bomb. How can prayers for peace be answered while the battle rages on? No more, no, no more nightmares. No more, no, no more bomb scares. For the sake of the ones we love. Shalom, shalom. Arab leaders, why can't you see what your rhetoric has done? Now your children turn to violence as the savior.